Hello, and welcome to Physics Frontiers, episode number 43, The Positive Energy Theorem. Show notes for this podcast can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/43. Show notes include links to papers we read on this podcast, links to related episodes, and anything else I think of that could be relevant.
All right. Well, hey, Randy, what's going on?
Good evening, James.
Oh, I am in trouble, aren't I?
Yep.
So what are we talking about today, Randy?
This is probably one of my favorite concepts in all of physics, actually, and I'm really surprised and delighted that we have something really interesting to share about it. The concept of negative mass in general relativity, which is, as you know, where all of the really fun stuff happens.
I guess we've talked about negative mass a couple of times, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When we've talked about it, we've talked about negative mass in different sort of aspects. Well, I guess mass has three aspects, at least. One is inertial, one is the active gravitational mass, and one is the passive gravitational mass. So which aspects are negative in this case?
Yeah, I was actually hoping to get some clarification from you on this, because I assume that they're always, well, these papers, and we're talking about two papers here. The first one was published in 2013, is called On Negative Mass, and the second one was published in 2014, called Negative Mass Bubbles in De Sitter Spacetime. So they one of the authors wrote on both of those papers, and it seems that he's talking about finding a way to generate a negative gravitational curvature using positive mass. Am I reading that right?
Well, I think for your negative mass bubbles, it's something like that. With his negative mass bubbles in De Sitter Spacetime, what it looks like to me is that there's a positive cosmological constant with a hole in it, and that's your negative mass bubble, right? So basically, you have a region where you've got what looks to me like you have a lot of mass all over the place, and at some point, it just very quickly goes down to zero. The idea is outside of that little bubble region, everything looks like it would look like if you had sort of that same positive cosmological constant minus some sort of negative effective mass.
That's a term that I don't think I'd ever seen before, was gravitational effective mass.
Yeah, effective mass is usually inertial and it's usually in a material. And so the way I was looking at this, which may be completely off, is that you have this positive cosmological constant, and if you have a bubble in it, right, if you have sort of an empty space in that, it's going to act like a negative mass would, because everything else has a positive mass. So you're still looking at it like you would in a material, right? You're saying that cosmological constant, it has the same sort of effect as being a material. And then this little region where you have less of that cosmological constant is that negative mass.
What really caught my eye about this is that whenever the concept of negative mass arises, whenever you want to talk about the really fun stuff like wormholes or gravitational field propulsion, time travel, negative mass is sort of pretty much required for all of these kind of different ideas, which would be a lot of fun to play with. Usually during that conversation, somebody raises the objection, but that violates the positive energy theorem, so it's non-physical. So, you know, adieu, sir. So it turns out that's not true. Because we are in a universe with a cosmological constant, that whole positive energy theorem objection doesn't apply to our universe. And this is the first time I've come across a good treatment in both of these papers that make that argument. And it's like, oh my God. Well, perhaps, especially in the second paper, it seems like we're talking about a real possibility of being able to engineer something like that, that has this property of negative mass. The idea in these papers, as I understand it, is because we are in a universe with a cosmological constant, which is positive, that our universe, especially in the inflationary epoch, but even now that it's when it's accelerating under what we call dark energy, that it's a De Sitter geometry, right? So there's a positive cosmological constant that kind of opens the door because it allows us to circumnavigate the positive energy theorems.
So yeah, the idea here is that because the universe would be asymptotically De Sitter-like, which I believe means because the universe is asymptotically expanding, therefore, there's an issue there. Now, I was wondering, how much do you know about this positive energy theorem? What can you explain about the positive energy theorem?
Well, there's apparently several of them, but basically what they are was physicists didn't like the idea of there being a negative mass, that it seemed to be unphysical, and we certainly don't know of any kind of particle that has negative mass. It seemed like general relativity was being too permissive with the kinds of solutions that it could describe. And so physicists came up with a positive energy theorem to say that mass is going to always be positive. And certainly if you start with a positive mass, then you can't make a negative space-time curvature using positive mass. This was an argument which, you know, has been proven in several different ways. There's been a number of papers written about it, which are really compelling, dating back, you know, decades. But they're all predicated on the idea that the universe is asymptotically flat. And we learned recently, in the last 20 years, that we're not in a flat universe, or not in an asymptotically flat universe. That is, we're not in a universe with no cosmological constant. Rather, we do appear to be in a universe with a cosmological constant. So it strikes me, ultimately, as kind of an ad hoc concept that just made everybody sleep easier at night, saying that, look, you can't have a negative mass. So you can't have all these fun toys that general relativity would give you if you could.
Yeah, in a way, that's sort of what's going on. I also read a paper by a guy named Komar from 1963 talking about this. And yeah, I mean, there were several different systems, and I think it's actually an open question whether or not you can do this in a more general sense. But there's several different systems where people were able to define a universe where the total energy was positive definite, at least in some sort of asymptotic way. But all of them had as a condition that the universe is asymptotically Minkowskian. They each had other different ways of doing this, and in some sense, these different ways define the mass. That's sort of another issue that is sort of pushed aside, is that the way they're defining the mass is itself a little bit problematic. So there are apparently three different kinds of mass, basically. There's a Arnowitz-Desner and Misner mass, which is probably the one that feels most like a regular mass. So in that case, it's measured on a surface of constant time parameter in your coordinate system. And that's just a constant number. That number just stays the same, no matter what goes on. There's like a Bondi mass, which is on a hypersurface. It's on like a slice of time that's a hyperboloid that eventually comes to be your forward-centered light cone. So it's just counting the mass there. That particular one is not constant. And then there's the Komar mass, which I had an idea about what it was actually doing before, and now I'm a little bit less sure. But after reading the Komar paper, now I'm less sure about what it means. But it had something to do with defining the energy density with killing fields and stuff like that, which are basically perpendicular generators of isotropies. But in all of these cases, what's really, really interesting is that the mass is not defined locally. The mass is only defined sort of asymptotically. Well, the mass is defined for the entire universe, but it's not defined for a thing. That doesn't make much difference because what they're looking at is the Schwarzschild metric, right? They're looking at Schwarzschild metrics to sort of determine what's going on, which is going to be the same for one of these papers. And in that case, you've only got really one object. So, you know, whatever you've defined as the mass ends up being the mass. And that mass is basically a 1 over R term in the 0-0 component of the metric tensor, of the time-time component of the metric tensor. What's really interesting to me is, and maybe we can talk about this in a later program, is that people are trying to figure out how to define mass locally in gravitational physics, but nobody has a really strong argument for this being the correct way to do that.
Yeah, I remember that coming up in a wonderful paper called Swimming in Space-Time by Jack Wisdom at MIT. You know, I didn't realize how difficult it can be to define classical concepts that we get familiar with in Newtonian physics within general relativity. But it gives you all kinds of wonderful opportunities to play around with momentum and mass. But the Schwarzschild solution, is that the correct pronunciation?
I think it's Schwarzschild. I don't really know. He never called me up. I guess that's in bad taste. I think he died fairly young.
Oh, that's a shame. And it's interesting that Bondi came up, because I know that Bondi worked on negative mass solutions to general relativity. And Robert Forward cited him when he wrote his negative matter propulsion paper in 1990. They were both, at least Robert Forward was a little bit frustrated that people kept saying, oh, this can't possibly be. And yet nobody could offer really a good logical reason why it couldn't be. And the response to that was ultimately the positive energy theorem. But as we're seeing in these papers, it appears that that doesn't apply to our universe. So I'm really rather thrilled with this discovery.
I'm not really sure. A little while ago, we were talking about differences between inertial masses and gravitational masses and so on. And, you know, the gravitational charge, that's a fairly easy thing to say, okay, well, they probably ought to be the same sort of things. But the whole idea about the different inertial masses, I was surprised in reading one of these papers that they were saying that the inertial masses would be negative two. But I have no idea how they know that the inertial masses would also be negative in this case.
Well, the odd thing that I found, if I'm reading this 2014 paper properly, is that the negative mass doesn't become evident until you reach a large distance from the radius.
Well, yeah. The whole idea of that particular case is that it's not really negative. The effective mass is negative. The real mass is not negative. The real mass is just a place where it goes to zero inside of this positive cosmological constant. But that means that if you look at it from a larger area, right, you have this little bubble of zero in this cosmological constant. According to this, as you go to a farther distance away from it, you know, you can't tell the difference between that zero and having some sort of constant, which in this case is negative added onto your mass.
So it would be repulsive gravitationally at a given distance, right?
It would be just the opposite of whatever that positive cosmological constant would be doing. You'd just have this hole, which would act like something that would have the opposite sign than the cosmological constant, because it was a hole. I mean, think about this like you'd think about like a hole in a semiconductor, right? A hole is a little region in the semiconductor where an electron has left and is gone doing its thing conducting. But now that hole, that little lack of an electron in the semiconductor, for basically hopping from atom to atom, right? The lack of an electron moves just like an electron moves, which basically means you get a positive charge moving around. So this negative mass that he's showing here seems to me, you've got something like that hole wandering around in space-time. That's the bubble.
Maybe I'm reading this wrong. If we look at section 3 of the first paper on negative mass, in section 3, it's called a particular class of solution. And he says here that we consider specific solutions corresponding to a bubble that has a non-singular core, a transition shell, and an exterior, which is an exact negative mass Schwarzschild de Sitter solution. So then he says a bubble containing a charged black hole and filled with a positive cosmological constant has a mass less than the constituent mass. And it says that the dominant energy condition is satisfied everywhere. So this is actually a physical possibility within general relativity. And then he says this object would behave like a negative mass given an appropriate magnitude of charge. That is a kind of complex picture that he's painting there. He's got a charged black hole, the bubbles containing a positive cosmological constant, and somehow resulting in a negative mass behavior out of that. So that seems a little more complicated than just a bubble in the cosmological field, you know? And then in the second paper, they're talking about a perfect fluid. This really rang a bell with me because I've been thinking along very similar lines lately, looking at the stress energy tensor and wondering if it would be possible to use those three components of the stress energy tensor that pertain to pressure. And if you could create enough negative pressure in those three components to be larger than the rest mass of the material itself to create a negative space-time curvature. And that's exactly the strategy that they took in the second paper. They're talking about using those exact terms. to arrive at a negative mass overall. But how that pertains to the bubble, I'm a little unclear of. I'm not really sure what kind of bubble they're talking about. And when they're talking about a perfect fluid, I assume that they mean a physical fluid. I'm not entirely sure about that, but because sometimes people describe space-time as a perfect fluid. So I'm not really sure if they're talking about a material body or not, but I assume that it is, because at some point they say here, we have shown that there exists a very physical configuration of an ideal fluid, which gives rise to solutions in the Einstein equations that correspond asymptotically to negative mass Schwarzschild de Sitter spacetimes. You know, it looks to me like there's actually physical material involved in both of those concepts.
In this paper, the charge is acting like the negative mass. So if you look at equation 13, the mass that you're observing, I guess the real mass, plus something that has to do with the cosmological constant, minus something that has to do with the charge on the black hole. So that's how they're producing that bubble, that empty spot. It's just a variation in the energy density of that spot, right? As far as the perfect fluid stuff, so that's sort of how they talk about these different things that have to do with pressure and density. They have this sort of perfect fluid that they use to describe all these different solutions in cosmology. So they just sort of say, okay, well, what happens if we have a perfect fluid and it has different sort of pressures and things like that? And that gives you your different solutions, which, you know, that we've talked about in different contexts. Well, we talked about that W before, that sort of equation of state. That W seems to be pretty well constrained at this point. It tells you already a lot about what can happen in the universe. To actually answer the question that you had, I think we have to actually look at what they think would happen if we have a good idea about what those values for the density and the pressure actually are. But I think that's something we could actually look at right now. We could calculate that W, and if we calculated that W for what you're trying to say, we could figure out if we have a dust-like solution, a Lorentz invariant vacuum, or a radiation solution, right? Those are the three that tend to show up because, you know, they give simple solutions. And they kind of have a meaningful idea, right? It's meaningful. What would happen if you just had dust all over the place, right? You basically have a constant mass, right? And your equation of state, that W is equal to zero. If you just have radiation everywhere, that W ends up being about one-third. And if you have a Lorentz invariant vacuum, you get that W equal to about minus one, which is kind of what we see. We see something near that, or at least they tell me from the experiments that that's where that W has to be in all of these things that we've read. Those are our sort of options. But we could do the same thing with your idea. If we can figure out how to mathematize your idea, we can probably do the same thing, calculate that W, figure out what's going on.
I guess theoretically, maybe there's a stringent limit on how extreme this negative mass factor can be. But it seems like even in principle, if we open the door to negative mass solutions, then you end up with these delightful effects like putting a positive and negative mass near each other and they all accelerate off indefinitely in a single direction because they have that kind of inverse gravitational effect.
Well, yeah, and that's exactly what they said in one of these papers, probably the first one, I think.
Because they talk about inflation. That could be like a driving mechanism, I suppose, for inflation, right?
Could be something that gives you inflation if you have something like that. But, you know, I'm not sure because, again, the inflation has to turn off.
Right. Yeah, what would have made it turn off?
Well, I mean, since things are supposed to be trailing each other, it should not have turned off as far as I understand.
Yeah, one of the questions that Robert Ford raised in that 1990 negative matter propulsion paper that has like reemerged in my thinking after seeing these papers was that perhaps negative and positive mass were created together at the beginning of the universe, and that now maybe those giant cosmic voids between, you know, the galaxies are actually populated by negative matter of some kind. Because negative matter doesn't coalesce gravitationally like positive matter does. So maybe at the center of those regions, you've got this kind of repulsive gravitational field pushing, you know, all of the galaxies onto their surfaces. So it looks kind of like soap bubbles, you know. That's fascinating to me. And he, even back in 1990, he was looking at that as a solution for possibly dark matter, too. The dark matter effect, because if you've got a repulsion from the outside from all these cosmic voids, it would cause the same effect as having a greater positive matter inside the galaxies.
All sorts of things show up if you can do this stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
But question has always been, can you? And I think that's the big issue, is that you want to see somehow the negative mass. And especially if it's going to have this negative inertial mass, that's something you want to see the evidence for.
Yeah, what I found most kind of refreshing about these papers is that they're very unambivalent about stating the physicality of these solutions. There was a quote, the line that struck me in the first paper. They say, in this essay, we find that negative mass solutions in a de Sitter geometry are perfectly physical. You know, that's really uncustomary in the academic literature.
I think what they're saying is that it's allowed by general relativity. And I don't think that is going to be denied, right? So if I read this paper by Komar from like 63, like I was saying, he's very careful about saying that if this, then this, if this, then this, if this, then this. You've got all of these different conditions that have to be met. And if all of these are met, then you have a positive, definite energy density. And then you have a positive mass, is the implication of that. But, you know, one of them, you need to have a source-free system that's non-singular, time-symmetric, axially symmetric, and asymptotically Schwarzschildian. So you're stuck with a region like that. In another one, you need an isotropic spatial metric on a space-like hypersurface with a second fundamental form being equal to zero, and so on. So, you know, the positive energy conjecture, the positive energy theorem, is proven, is a theorem for very specific instances. And again, like I said, for all of these, they have the Minkowskian limit at the edges. You're sort of attaching your metric to a flat space-time far away from any sources, far away from any masses.
Oh, okay. I was wondering how that geometry was working, because I saw where they were talking about that, the converging world lines and everything. And I guess if you've got a cosmological constant that's positive, like our universe, then they diverge. They don't go flat. Oh, that's really interesting.
So instead of having a flat space-time, you've got something diverging. Yeah.
Were you able to follow what they're talking about? I mean, one of the things that I really liked about this that I hadn't even thought of before was that they're treating these, at least in the first paper, the masses as singularities. And I had never considered before that a naked singularity appears with a negative mass equivalent of a black hole.
Yeah, I had not heard that before.
And what they worked out in both papers was that that's not a problem. That we sort of have a technique for dealing with naked electrical charges. And so this would be similar to that in form, and that the space-time is fully conforms to the dominant energy condition at all points beyond the singularity. So they think it's feasible to exist.
What I recall here is they just said, well, what we're not going to do is actually have that singularity.
Yeah, they're going to blur it out like we do with an electrical charge, right?
So we're going to say that there's an energy density. We're going to say there's a mass density at this spot, and that mass density never really goes to infinity because we've smeared it out, is what you're saying there. But normally, when you use a point charge, it's only as an approximation to a charge on a sphere, right, or something like that, or charge on an object. That charge is distributed all over that object. Now, I don't know what this means as far as the charge of an elementary particle, because those things are supposed to be point objects, and I don't know how you smear them around.
I'm guessing that it has something to do with position momentum uncertainty, right?
You might be able to do something like that, but I don't really think that's viable for this case. You know, when the charge interacts with the field, it interacts at a point. When the electron interacts with a photon, they interact at a point. So at least at that elementary particle level, I don't think this works. But if you're looking at this at on a macroscopic level, you're still able to look at those densities instead. But of course, is general relativity going to work at that scale?
Yeah, I guess we can't really know what's going to happen with that until we have a quantum theory of gravity. Because when you're talking about points, you're starting getting into that realm, right?
I mean, it's perfectly fine as long as nothing actually gets close enough to fall into that point. And the positive singularity, we don't see what happens because of the event horizon, but something actually happens anyway. You don't really get a free pass with that. Something happens at that singularity, just because we don't get to see it. I mean, that doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
Yeah, I was reading some fun articles about the recent gravity wave detections. And they were saying how with more precision, you know, once we can really detect the exact waveform of these gravitational waves, that we should be able to sort of see inside the event horizon. It'll tell us information about what's going on at the singularity when these collisions happen.
Well, that'll be fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I think right now they're probably just delighted that they can see a bump in the detector signal. But one of these days they're going to have it so refined that we're going to be mapping what's going on inside the event horizon when black holes collide. And that's fascinating. Apparently black holes ring. They ring when they collide. And they can glean information on how they ring about what's happening in there, you know.
All you have to do is wait to find a couple of black holes colliding.
Yeah, and that happens with odd frequency if you can detect them halfway across the observable universe, which is seems like they're pretty much doing. I don't know how many billions of light years away some of these events have been, but it's incredible how far away they've been. That decays with like the inverse cube, doesn't it? The signal strength for gravity waves?
It should do something like that. It's quadrupole, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So, what else have we got here?
Let's see, they talk about the negative mass configurations in a De Sitter universe would have important consequences for the early universe. I guess that was where they were talking about the inflation and everything, right? Oh, one of the things they raised was also if we could find a mechanism for pair production of positive negative mass pairs. And they were saying that that could produce in the early universe this strange gravitational plasma. And they're saying that that plasma in the early universe would dampen the long gravitational waves from, I guess, the birth of the universe. So I guess maybe someday we might be able to see if that's true. You know, we might be able to detect gravitational waves from the early universe and then see if those low frequencies do get screened, in which case we could prove that pair production was happening. But how that happens, I have no idea. I guess the physics were a lot different during the inflationary epoch because the different laws of physics hadn't broken symmetry yet, right?
That's what they tell me.
All right. Let's see. What else do we talk about here? Do you understand what they're talking about in that first paper when they talk about a bubble containing a charged black hole in the cosmological constant? What is the bubble? Is that just an arbitrary demarcation line, or is that a material bubble? I'm not really sure how to visualize this.
I was reading that as just sort of a small region of space. I don't think they're talking about a physical bubble, right, that you can produce. It seems to me like there's just a region of space where you've got something. Like if you look at in the second paper where they have a function for that effective mass, they have the function for the mass and it has three different regions. So that's your bubble. And at the very center, you have no mass. Then you have something that increases cubically, and then you have something that increases cubically that's multiplied by the cosmological constant minus the thing that is your negative mass. So basically what that's saying is that you have this transition region between what looks like a region with positive cosmological constant and the region with zero net mass. So that's sort of what I was reading this as, is they have this region of zero net mass, they have this far region that looks like a cosmological constant, and then you have a transition region between them. And if you were to just look at that at the far distance and see that cosmological constant trend, you'd say, well, over at this spot at the center of this object, let's say, that object has a negative mass. And so I'd expect, according to this, that that would be your charged black hole.
God, that's fascinating. Boy, I wish we could experiment with this. And, you know, wouldn't it be fun if we could experiment with this and test this out?
Well, I mean, if you have a charged black hole handy, I can come by next week.
Well, one of the things that I come across when I'm studying general relativity is this idea that it's not the mass itself that is relevant to the intensity of the gravitational field as much as the energy density.
To what degree is that a different thing?
I don't know. I mean, it just seems like instead of needing perhaps an entire collapsed star to create these extreme gravitational effects, maybe if you just had a very, very small region, like a thin envelope, where you could force the density to be extremely high, you know, maybe the thickness of a molecule, that you could get these intense gravitational gradients. Am I thinking about that wrong?
I think you could probably do the math on that and figure out that it has to be much smaller than a molecule. That's sort of my guess. To get these really high masses, you need a whole lot of pressure and stuff like that, which you only get with a lot more mass around. So to get these really high densities, you've got a lot of things going on in a star or something like that. Actually, something much denser than a star to get these sorts of effects that we're thinking about. The pressures that you can make terrestrially are actually really, really small on that scale.
Well, I don't know. I mean, when we collide particles and particle accelerators like gold nuclei, they smash them together and to create like a quark gluon plasma. That's got to be pretty dense, huh?
I have no idea what those densities are. They might not be dense at all.
I just thought they had to be super high density because they're always talking about it in terms of recreating conditions that are similar to like the first instant of the Big Bang, you know, like they're reaching energy levels, which I assume are associated with density. For, you know, a fraction, I mean, an instantaneous fraction of a second. But nevertheless, I always got the impression we're talking about, like, early universe type of densities, energies, you know? I'll have to do some research on that.
Yeah, we have to actually look at that. Quark gluon plasma, that's another good idea. All right, so anything else you can think about?
So I just wish these papers had been a little bit longer and a little more detailed and had talked more about consequences and, you know, just done a little more exploring on what it would mean physically. Because, like you said, I don't think the question was answered of really what the real-world behavior of these would be in like an experimental situation. It would have been nice to see some hypotheses and see some development of those ideas. Like, if you were interacting with these negative mass bubbles, would they behave like they had a negative inertial mass?
Well, that's what they claimed in at least one of these papers.
But I guess that's only at the distance at which that negative effective gravitational mass is indicated, right? So there'd be other regions where it would have a positive inertial mass. That's tricky. It's interesting, though.
You know, I assume that in the end, what you care about here is what it looks like more or less asymptotically at infinity or something like that. Because of that, what's actually happening close by to them is still not really well defined, which is sort of the whole point. The negative mass bubbles that you see are there because, you know, you're looking at the limit of this de Sitter spacetime. You see them in that mass function because you've already taken that limit and gotten rid of sort of the local effect of the mass, which again is not really well defined in these theories.
Now, it's a little hard for me to just look at these equations and get any sense about what their numerical meaning is going to be because they're set to like natural units. But I'm wondering, this the fact that our cosmological constant at the current time in our universe's history, because that's so small, does that mean that we couldn't foresee an ability to actually play with this kind of thing? That we wouldn't be able to detect this negative effective mass scenario? You know, is this going to be so impractical in terms of engineering that there's no way we could ever see these kind of effects? Because our cosmological constant is really tiny, right? Like, you only see it over, like, huge cosmological scale, so its energy density must be very small. Does that stop us from seeing anything fun in the future with this kind of work?
If you can see these negative masses, then they should show up somewhere. And if they're only going to show up with charged black holes, or if they even show up with charged black holes, then you should see some interesting behavior with charged black holes. I mean, all you have to do is identify which black holes are charged, and then everything's easy.
I wonder how many black holes are charged. I mean, I was reading somewhere there's an argument that really any kind of electrical charge in space is going to approach a neutral condition pretty quickly, but the extreme conditions around an event horizon and everything might change that. You've got a plasma, you've got different interactions. I wonder if most black holes are charged or not, you know? I know that most of them are spinning, right? So they've got a ring-like singularity rather than a point. But if only we had Romulan technology, then we could, you know, have a singularity and charge it however we liked and then create our negative mass solutions that would give us warp drive. Bingo.
You've got it all figured out again, Randy.
You know it. Well, all right, Jim. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me about this fun idea. I'm delighted that even in principle, we can now say that negative mass solutions are not barred from our universe. So we can at least work on some fun theoretical developments.
Thanks for talking. I'll talk to you again next week or whatever that is.
All right. Great, Jim. Well, you have a wonderful night. And thanks again for taking your time to talk with me about my favorite concept in physics.
Bye now.
Good night. Good night, Jim.
Thank you for listening to Physics Frontiers, episode number 43, The Positive Energy Theorem. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.43, where you can find links to papers that we read on this program, links to related episodes that we may have discussed, and anything else that I think might be relevant to the discussion.